from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, in the upcoming hour ahead, the East Bay Express calls it the bacon-wrapped economy, once diverse, affordable neighborhoods transforming into hotbeds of techie hipsterism. The debate over gentrification is a perennial one, but it has reached a fever pitch in recent months. Still, the loaded G-word means different things to different people and encompasses thorny issues of race, class, development, and displacement. As part of our Priced Out series, we asked several leading Bay Area thinkers and you, our listeners, what gentrification means, and not only to you, but to the region, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this hour, as part of our ongoing Priced Out series, we turn our attention to the tension and controversy around what many have characterized as growing gentrification in many neighborhoods in the Bay Area. What exactly is gentrification? Is it always a bad thing? And does neighborhood improvement always have to lead to displacement of longtime residents? We're going to look at some of those questions and discuss the effects of the demographic changes that are occurring and have already occurred. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We have here in studio a number of dignitaries with us, and let me introduce them to you. With us, Rebecca Solnit, well-known writer and author who actually is an essayist, probably best known for Unfathomable City. Her newest book is, I should say, Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas. Her other books are Hollow City, Gentrification and the Eviction of Urban Culture. And welcome back, Rebecca Solnit.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Randy Shaw here with us in the studio, who directs the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, which provides housing and legal services for low-income tenants. And he writes about gentrification in his newest book, The Activist Handbook, second edition, Winning Social Change in the 21st Century. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you, Michael.
We also have Idale Nzinga with us, artistic director of the Lower Bottom Playas. It's a participation in ongoing an ongoing photography exhibit here before Art from a Contested Space at the Fremery Park, also known as Little Bobby Hutton Park in West Oakland. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also want to welcome Farhad Manju, technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal, formerly with Slate. His article, The Care and Feeding of a Tech Boom, appeared in San Francisco Magazine in September. Welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you. Good to have you all here. And I'm going to begin with Rebecca Solnit, who has taken a rather strong position against what she defines as gentrification. And, a poet city this no longer is, I guess, is kind of the summing up of what you have to say in many respects. But also it goes deeper than that. A lot of displacement, a lot of buses that are taking people to, I was struck by your language in the London Review of Books, where you said taking people to what seems like the Prussian army replacing the Parisians. Are we being vanquished by this gentrification?
Funny you ask, Michael. Yes. You know, there's a bunch of stuff. There's a bunch of layers to it. There's specific and individual cases of eviction and unaffordable housing. There's a question of what does a healthy city include? And I think it needs a huge diversity. You need people who work in auto body shops and work in daycare and work in hospitals. You don't just need a bunch of white collar tech workers. You know, there's a cultural continuity and memory of the city that gets displaced when you have all these, you know, when so many newcomers come and become the dominant culture. You know, it's been a city of newcomers since the gold rush, but these sudden surges tend to wash away what was there before. And then finally, what's really interesting, San Francisco was the capital of the West. It's been a city with a huge identity and cultural contribution for 160 years or so. And now it feels like it's becoming a suburb of Silicon Valley, which is a very different beast altogether.
Are you looking at the techies as kind of another mutation of the barbarian hordes here? I mean, aren't they regular citizens? Don't they play their role?
You can tell it as the barbarian hordes storming Rome, or you can tell it as the Romans storming some misty, remote part of Northern Europe, you know, the British Isles or Germany or something. There's just, you know, many of them are individually lovely people. The cumulative effect of so many young, rich, busy people, mostly white, mostly male, you know, is homogenizing the city and displacing the economic and employment diversity and ethnic diversity in ways that are really disturbing.
I think in your article you're saying it's difficult now for those who are dissidents or use the word queers, pacifists, environmentalists or experimentalists, all those people who take refuge in San Francisco. But it's also, as you mentioned, in terms of employment, making it very difficult for teachers and firefighters and mechanics and carpenters.
Yeah. And, you know, years ago, the first model we had of that was resort cultures, places like Jackson Hole, where only millionaires live, and the people who actually like make their beds and make their lattes actually drive into Jackson Hole, Wyoming from Idaho and places like that, sometimes die on the passes in winter. And, you know, it's not a community, it's not a healthy ecosystem when only affluent people, when only people who do certain kinds of work or belong to certain sectors live there. And I think a healthy city, you need many kinds of people literally to keep it running. And it's, you know, I look at the busboys in the restaurants and the people who work in daycare and the bus, you know, the Google bus drivers do not make $200,000 a year like the Google engineers. I think they make $18 an hour. Where are those people supposed to live? What kind of, you know, marginal corner have we consigned them to, or insane commute from places like Tracy? And what kind of a community do we have when those people are excluded? You know, I want to see the rich, diverse ecosystem that isn't, you know, and it's often posed as, oh, artists are being kicked out. And they're sort of an indicator species, but all kinds of people. You know, it's interesting in many places. I have a cousin who's a firefighter with a rent-controlled apartment in Manhattan, and everyone thinks that he has a trust fund because firefighters do not live in Manhattan. And, like, what kind of a city can't, you know, doesn't even have room for its own firefighters? Well,
forgive me. We've been talking about firefighters being not able to afford living in San Francisco since the 70s and 80s. This is not a new phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, part of it is that firefighters could possibly be paid more. But also it's I think we're not, you know, we're letting a lot of the people who've been in charge of our urban development, the direction we go, are convinced that all money is good money and all affluence is good affluence. And we have a kind of affluence that creates massive poverty of sectors and individuals, but I think also of culture and of the wholeness of this and richness of the city, as, you know, and what San Francisco is famous for is a kind of dissident culture. You know, we're the place where the Sierra Club was born, where a lot of great poetry came out in the 50s, a lot of music in the 60s and after and stuff. And that's based on people who are doing something other than the most lucrative white-collar thing they can possibly imagine doing. Doing stuff out of idealism, out of ideology, out of passion, and a lot of times out of cheap apartments.
Well, let me get beyond San Francisco a bit with you, Farhad Manjoo. I mean, you've been talking and writing about the fact that things look a lot rosier, especially down in San Mateo, where the paychecks are considerably heavier. I almost said more obese. There are a lot of gains because of technology, and unemployment's gone down. I think at one point you said in your writing, San Francisco, get over yourself. Things are looking much better from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually agree with a lot of what Rebecca just said. I think that the diversity and the kind of cultural diversity and economic diversity that we have in San Francisco and that we enjoyed is the main reason, I would say, that we have this tech boom here. You know, a lot of people think of tech workers as being somehow apart from kind of San Francisco's creative culture. But I think that a lot of tech workers think that they are part of that culture, that, you know, coding is a kind of creativity. I mean, there's studies that show that those kinds of, you know, centers like that, cultural centers that value diversity, that are very liberal cultural centers, attract these workers because these workers want to be part of that culture. So I think I would suggest that the tech industry sort of needs that culture and needs to kind of foster it. I think where I disagree is that, like, there's this very oppositional sense that I get from talking to people in the tech industry and people who sort of want more housing or more development and people who sort of want San Francisco to stay the same or stay the way it's always been. I think that the way forward for San Francisco is to kind of recognize that we're in this very transformative time in the global economy, where software is becoming kind of the central center of every transformative event in business. And San Francisco is kind of the main place for that. And it's going to become, I think, you know, one of the next global capitals. And it seems to me there's not much planning for how to maintain San Francisco while accommodating that.
Well, that's why you've been saying build more, build higher, and you know, build more housing is the key.
I mean, when you talk to sort of housing experts in the city, even though there are housing experts on every side of this issue, I mean, there are many people know that we haven't built enough housing over the last 20 or 30 years to accommodate the kind of population influx that we're seeing now and that we're going to continue to be seeing if this tech boom holds up. And, you know, people I talked to have suggested that it's possible to build housing in many places in the city in more high-density housing while not transforming the, you know, the way San Francisco feels to a lot of people while
but you
not
also,
making it into Manhattan.
Well, but a denser city is, I think, from your perspective, seen as much more of a positive thing. You have a larger tax base here with these techie workers too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we don't have a denser city, then it seems almost certain that the tech workers, the people who just made millions in that Twitter IPO, will, you know, buy up all available real estate and we'll see you know, an acceleration of the problem that we're seeing now. It seems likely. It seems that, you know, building more housing, even if the criticism is that a lot of the housing that's being built is being built for the upper income, especially the high rises, which is true. But if you build more housing for those people, at least they're not bidding up the, all the rest of the housing.
And again, Farhad Maju is technology columnist with the Wall Street Journal, formerly with Slate. We also have Ida Leyte Nzengo with us in studio, artistic director of the Lowell and Byron Playas. And let's talk about West Oakland with you. There's been a real transformation there. I mean, two times the number of white people moving in the past decade, a lot of them these tech workers, African Americans being driven out or leaving. No more the Harlem of the West, is it?
Not quite. And it is unfortunate to see culture overridden. And density is an interesting word. Density is being achieved in West Oakland by taking former one-family homes and dividing them into four units and charging as much rent on each unit as the entire family home cost. This, of course, displaces people. In development without consciousness is an interesting thing, aligning with what Rebecca said, that all affluence is good affluence is not necessarily true if you want to create a truly diverse space. Diversity is also an interesting word. It means different things to different people. Diversity truly means difference in every conceivable way that you can think of somehow harmoniously being able to exist in the same spot. I'd like to draw attention to the fact that, you know, people talk about displacement. I actually like to call it hurting. I remember interviewing Jerry Brown back in his tenure as Oakland mayor when elegant density was his cry. And I asked him where the people who were poor, unemployed, and undereducated, who lived in the areas that he envisioned elegant density taking place, where were those people going to go? And his answer was he did not know, but they would not be there. That becomes the real question for me. What people are allowed to acquire in a capitalist society. They are allowed to move, and people should be able to live where they want to. This includes techies and grandmas on fixed incomes who have lived in the same place for 30 years and raised their kids there. So when people are herded to bedroom communities or places where Native Americans wouldn't establish communities, how then are they supposed to become invested in this system where, in many cases, gentrification, which I like to call neocolonialism, is actually taking place in areas where people of color were forced to settle? West Oakland and East Oakland were the areas that welcomed black people in Oakland during the northern migrations that occurred after emancipation and after the World War. you could not be in certain parts of Oakland. Entertainers weren't allowed to perform downtown Oakland. Same thing with South Berkeley, which has quietly been gentrified as well. So we have areas where you were forced to purchase or economics allowed you to live that are now being overridden. And these people are going to places like Antioch, Pittsburgh, Tracy, where there are no jobs. And the same base problems that made West Oakland underserved and economically unviable exist in those places.
Excuse me, when you use a synonym like neocolonialism, though, mm-hmm. you have to define that for me. Why is this neocolonialism?
Both gentrification and colonialism, as it's traditionally thought of, come into areas that may be occupied by indigenous people. And they develop these areas for their own benefit without regard to what happens to the people that currently exist there. I find it only a whisper away from the settling of this country altogether. There were people here. There were people here. There was a culture here. And that culture was contained in order for this culture to come into being. When you go into places like West Oakland and you look at that place as if it is only raw land and the potential for development, and you don't see what's already there, that's a colonial gaze that only sees what can be developed and does not see what's there. And further, it doesn't really care about how that place came to be the way it was. I hear lots of conversations about where we're coming into an area where there were no lights, you know, there were slow police response, and now the schools are better. There was nothing wrong with those things when the traditional residents lived there. So for these things to then come into existence for the benefit, everybody can't afford a $12 sandwich. Everybody's not doing 450 lattes in the morning. Grocery stores that spring up and sell beautifully organic food, and a steak is $12. This is obviously for the new population. It is not for the existing population.
Let me come in here and take that and segue over to Randy Shaw, who says that when you talk about gentrification in San Francisco and you apply it to a place like the Tenderloin, it's oxymoronic. Doesn't exist, really, as we're talking about it here. I mean, right. There's just not enough development or not enough going on as neocolonial as it's been defined.
Well, I think, Michael, the question, gentrification as coming out of England meant the replacement or displacement of working class and middle class residents by more affluent residents. And I think in San Francisco, for many progressives, the only understanding they have of neighborhood improvement is gentrification. And I think in areas like mid-market, and particularly with the publicity in the last week around Twitter, the idea that mid-market, which is an extremely troubled area and has been so for almost 50 years, shouldn't be improved because that's somehow gentrification, that's the problem where I disagree. And I think that there are not a lot of residents in mid-market. There's been displacement before Twitter ever got here, an entire building. Rebecca's co-author, her photographer for Hollow City, lived in the Grant building. I represented all the tenants, and we stopped their eviction in 2000, way before Twitter ever was heard of. And then they ended up just getting the entire building vacated. Well, again, well before Twitter. And there's some buildings like 1049 Market Street where we're trying to keep the residents, and we will keep the residents in play. But in the big picture, places like Mid-Market and the Tenderloin need improvement. Yet every time a restaurant or a new bar opens up in the Tenderloin, I'm told, I guess that's gentrification, as if our residents aren't allowed to have any local businesses, they have to have high crime areas, that the poor people of the city that everyone on this panel wants to keep, who are saying we need a safer street for our children. We have 4,000 kids in the Tenderloin, and having neighborhood businesses is helpful. Having more positive night activity will crowd out the drug dealers. That shouldn't be seen as gentrification. We have to understand that there is no displacement. As I describe in my book, The Activist Handbook, How We Saved the Tenderloin, the first chapter talks about our major battle to rezone the Tenderloin, to pass all kinds of laws. The Tenderloin cannot be gentrified. Now, it is an exception in San Francisco, without question. But I think I wish as much time would be spent by progressives in thinking, hey, how do we make the Tenderloin a livable place for the people we want to stay? We have the kind of diverse community that Rebecca wants, but we can't get people to feel they can go out at night after dark. So that's not successful.
And can you really talk about that, gentrification, though? I mean, you're giving us a kind of etymological use of the word, you know, going back to its origins. And I mean, can you really talk about gentrification in a town which is largely, and I could say the same about Oakland as well as San Francisco, towns that are largely have rent control, organized labor, are progressive in their politics, majority tenant cities, really, by any standards, and that goes up against the idea of what is so often labeled as gentrification.
Well, the major waves of gentrification in San Francisco occurred in the 1980s. The Upper Haight, Noe Valley, Guerrero Street and above, which used to be the Mission, became very expensive in the 80s. But I think what people are talking about now is the fact that the vacant apartments, which are not governed by rent control. See, the problem with trying to address gentrification in San Francisco is single-family homes aren't regulated and vacant apartments aren't regulated under state law. And the Ellis Act preempts local just cause evictions.
So a lot of people are being thrown out and displaced. No question.
So, but I think in the big picture, this is the trends that Rebecca describes have really been occurring since the late 70s, as you suggest. And this is a city with a very small amount of land and therefore a huge demand for people to live here, and prices are going to go up. But I think we need to look at the big picture and say that Valencia Street is not San Francisco. And I think sometimes we're looking, so many people look at the problems in San Francisco with the lens of Valencia Street, which has been incredibly gentrified. Go out to Ocean Avenue, go out to the outer Richmond, go out to the Sunset, and San Francisco hasn't changed as much as people believe. A lot of the city isn't totally transformed by tech culture. And I find it odd that activists who had such great victories over the past 30 years now suddenly believe that in a 3-year period, all those victories have been destroyed by tech. Because I don't think it's true. I think our progressive values, and I wrote about this in Beyond Crime, how our progressive values have actually reshaped tech. Tech is now supporting tax increases. Tech supported the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Now, that's something that you don't often hear about, that we've gotten tech. The tech people who come to Twitter ride their bikes. They want bikes being passed down Market Street. They want to be we've always gotten a more progressive, affluent person. The UC Med doctors who make very good incomes and no one ever complains about as gentrifying, but they have the same impact as Twitter. When you see Med expand, we get the most progressive doctors. We have the doctors who support single-payer health care. So if you look at voting patterns in San Francisco, we are as progressive as ever despite rising affluence.
And let me just get back to the Tenderloin a minute, because you have thousands of residential units near 8th Street under construction, right?
We do. And Trinity Plaza, which has always been a working-class place and is still working-class, building around the corner from me, which the Chronicle has had a story on, 1800 for a studio. But, you know, in the Tenderloin, we have working-class families, and the studios, the prices have always been high. They started $1,400 for a studio in an area that's always been low income.
All right, we're coming up on a break, and I want to get our listeners involved in this. In fact, we asked our listeners on Facebook to complete the sentence, gentrification is. Here are some responses. Matt says, inevitable. Cindy writes, part of an ongoing issue while living in one of the most expensive areas of the country. I don't like it, but I seriously doubt anything can stop it. Seth says, it's an oft misused term. Alan says, gentrification is great if you own, bad if you rent, and can't afford more. Liam writes, gentrification is for those with little or no access to online social media platforms being displaced by those who probably work for those same online social media platforms. We'll get your responses on Facebook. We'll also get your responses by phone. You can join us now at our toll-free number. We do welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786. If you want to weigh in here on this conversation, what is gentrification to you, and what are your concerns about it, or maybe what are your good feelings about it? You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll hear from you when we return and remind you that we have a whole panel here, and you are also enjoined to join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Most artists can't afford to live here, and they're moving to places like, you know, Oakland or anywhere in the East Bay, and it is really killing the culture and the Mission. A lot of the reason why people live here in the Mission is because the murals and the culture here, and that's definitely going away, I've noticed. You know, art spaces are being replaced with cafes, and that's kind of a shame.
Well, the Outer Sunset used to be a kind of a quiet, boring neighborhood, and now it's becoming kind of hip, full of young tech worker types who are really raising the rents. They can afford it.
And of course, it's a sad thing that people have to move out. That there's no doubt about that. And I feel sorry for them. That's kind of the evolution of city, really.
Those are the voices of Zachary Gentman, Miles Miller, and Essie Salonen, interviewed by our intern Angela Johnson here in the Mission District in San Francisco. And we're talking really about gentrification, about demographic changes, loss of character, loss of diversity, and what it all means as rents go up and as cost of housing goes up. The East Bay Express calls it the bacon-wrapped economy, once diverse, affordable neighborhoods transforming into hotbeds of, well, techie hipsterism. And the debate over gentrification is certainly a perennial one, but it's reached pretty much a fever pitch in the recent months. And the loaded word gentrification means certainly different things to different people, as we're finding out here. Rebecca Solnit here with us in studio, author and essayist. Her most recent book with co-author Rebecca Snedeker is Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas. She's also author of Hollow City, Gentrification and the Eviction of Urban Crime. And she'll be appearing tonight at the third floor McRusky Mattress Factory, and Tuesday at Moe's Books in Berkeley, at 7 o'clock tonight and 7:30 tomorrow. Randy Shaw is with us, director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, which provides housing and legal services for low-income tenants. And he writes about gentrification, not only in Beyond Crom, but in his new book, The Activist Handbook, second edition, Winning Social Change in the 21st Century. Ayodele Nzenga with us as well, artistic director of the Lower Bottom Playas, a participant in an ongoing photography exhibit here, Before Art, from a contested space at DeFremery Park, also known as Little Bobby Hutton Park in West Oakland. And Farhad Manju, technology columnist with The Wall Street Journal, formerly with Slate. His article, The Care and Feeding of a Tech Boom, appeared in San Francisco Magazine back in September, and we certainly do welcome your involvement. In fact, this is when things become interactive, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Also, a number of other ways to join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to some emails here. And Dan writes, change is continuous. Before West Oakland became the Harlem of the West, it was virtually all white, low crime, good schools. When blacks moved in, whites left. Gertrude Stein was referring to West Oakland when she said of her old neighborhood, there is no there there. Well, you want to respond to that, Heidelise?
I would love to. Okay. West Oakland started out as a very diverse community. People connected with the gold rush, and like I said, people who were driven here by war industry jobs. And although it was diverse, it had the, and it's interesting, when we start talking about people of color or the word white, because, okay, you can say that there were a large number of white people there, but they were mostly immigrants, and they were not the type of white people who were welcomed in the hills and the suburbs. So you had working class people in West Oakland. White flight, I'm sorry, your respondent there is incorrect. White flight actually occurred quite some time later, around about the time that East Oakland was opened up because of the density of African Americans in West Oakland. It, again, was a place where black people were allowed to buy and to live. And as early as the first housing project in America, Peralta Villa, over in West Oakland, that's the beginning of gentrification, actually, in West Oakland. It's a process that has taken over 50 years. The beginning of the tearing down of blocks of houses in West Oakland, and land being allowed to go fallow for a post office that was built several years later, and the BART project, both projects that couldn't have happened in any other part of the city. That is around the time when white flight occurred, and it was left to be basically a black enclave. And it wasn't always as crime-riddled as it is today. 7th Street was like New York. It never closed. There was all sorts of industry, mom-and-pop industry, that was started and maintained by the people who were forced to live in this area. Those things very, very gradually declined. Deinvestment is a stage in gentrification where those areas are no longer developed. Things like Red Star Yeast, which existed for years, they're compromising the health, making West Oakland an asthma cluster, couldn't be moved until the population started to shift. And
let me shift to another question here, because in the interest of time, we've got a lot of callers, too, and I want to just go to Rebecca with this, because Dave writes, may I suggest saying progress in place of gentrification? It means the same thing and is easier to spell. And P.S., firefighters in the Bay Area earn $200,000 or more, including benefits.
You know, I wasn't talking about, you know, I'm not an expert on Bay Area firefighters. I was talking about New York in that example, but it was just an example of crucial people being unable to live in a city. Progress is a word that's been used to justify everything from genocide to, you know, and it's a meaningless word. And it's like my progress is your annihilation. And it gets used that way a lot. So it also suggests that this stuff is inevitable and it's not. It's the result of specific decisions by the people who govern the Bay Area, by the nature of our economy and other phenomena, you know, and you're supposed to be a loser or delusional or something if you resist progress. But this, you know, this isn't progress. The word itself is problematic, and we need to talk about what's really going on with better language.
Farad, here's a listener. Michelle says, I keep hearing certain experts suggest that building more high-end housing will take care of all the millionaires, leaving the rest of the housing for the rest of us. However, the fact is that those techies want to live in trendy neighborhoods and Victorians, and that is a serious problem in existing neighborhoods, which are experiencing the eviction boom.
I don't know if we can speak to where all techies want to live. I mean, they probably want to live in all different parts
of
the city.
They want to live well. That's
well, I mean, right. So I mean, a lot of what's happening is, you know, not all of the techies are IPO millionaires right now. A lot of them are expecting to be IPO millionaires, and they're coming in with relatively low salaries because that's sort of their expected payoff. So they're spending a huge portion of their rent, of their salaries on rent at the moment, too. And I think this is a problem for the tech companies. I mean, they will have to figure out some way to keep attracting people to the city if rents keep rising. I guess I disagree also with the person who said we should call this progress. I think we should call this change, and we should figure out how to how to live with this change, like whether we want the change, whether we mitigate some portions of it to figure out how to allow firefighters to live in the city. I mean, one of the things that's happening is we're getting rising inequality in the city, and we have ways to. There are well-known ways in economics to fix that. We could just raise taxes on people. I mean, that's possible. That's a conversation to have. But it seems like, you know, a lot of times we're not having these conversations because we get sort of stopped at the first step, which is, do we want these people here? Not what should we do about the fact that people are coming here?
Well, that brings up another question from Andy in Oakland, Randy Shaw, who says, gentrification, when white people with no money start to complain about white people with money, imagine how bad it is for the rest of us. he has a point. There was an article, I guess, in the New Republic, you probably, a guy named Greenberg wrote all about, he said, what's really happening here is middle-class people are being driven out by people who are richer than they are. They're taking over.
Well, I do think Oakland is different. I mean, San Francisco, is different demographic than Oakland. And I think Oakland is a very, very interesting thing what's going on because, like, the people who work for my nonprofit, you know, our employees, our organizing crew live in Oakland. The people who Rebecca talks about, the people who could live in San Francisco in the 80s, the nonprofit worker, the people who earn, you know, under $50,000 a year, now are moving to Oakland, and many of them are not African-American, say. And so they then are taking up the units that African-Americans would otherwise have had. And so now is that gentrification? One of the issues about gentrification where I always have a problem with is not everyone who earns. If you have a job, you're not the gentry. I mean, in San Francisco, you're legally considered under the standards of the Mayor's Office of Housing. If you earn $57,000 a single person, you qualify as low income. But we take anyone – so if a white person on my staff moves to Oakland, to West Oakland, takes a unit up, are they gentry because they're white, even if their income is only $35,000 or $40,000 or $45,000? It used to be that gentry meant more affluent people, and it wasn't a race-based analysis. So that, when race gets into it, as it's gotten in the Mission and in West Oakland, it gets more complex. But I do think the spillover effect in Oakland. One reason people keep saying Oakland's more of a happening place, and now they have Uptown Oakland, and they have 5,000 people in their arts nights. It's because whites have moved to Oakland, and Asians have moved to Oakland, and it's not an increase in the black population, which is actually declining, and that's considered great. Everyone loves Uptown Oakland, and no one's really talking about that. A few people are, like on the panel, but as gentrification in some respect.
I mean, I think what people mean when they say gentrification a lot of times is that there are people of a certain they may not make a lot of money. At least they may not make a lot of money right now at tech companies or in whatever other profession they're in, right? You know, they may be expecting to get money at some point from IPOs. But I think they're part of a new kind of culture to San Francisco, or one that, you know, was here briefly in the 90s and then went away after the end of the tech boom. You know, they're engineers and they're web designers, which is, there are different kinds of people than have been here than were here 20 years ago.
Let me read some more emails here. Just read some of these ideas that are coming in from different listeners. Andy from Oakland writes, I am getting so tired of hearing the term gentrification when referring to Oakland, Tiburon, Sausalito, Carmel. That's certainly gentrification when a rough and tumble fishing village becomes an enclave. But there are Victorians on 8th Street and throughout West Oakland that were not built to house blues musicians and railway porters. Oakland is full of Bernard Maybeck homes, quiet tree-lined streets, and is not historically the gritty urbanized place it has become since World War II. Let's set the record straight. Another listener says about Oakland, Christina, there are incredibly diverse neighborhoods in Oakland that are still very affordable. We would love new buyers to come in and bring new energy. If that's gentrification, bring it on. Joseph writes, gentrification is progress. What is lack of gentrification? Stagnancy. What is the opposite of gentrification? Neglect. Not many people want to live in a stagnant or neglected neighborhood. If people work to improve their neighborhood, culture, safety, schools, appearance, they have to accept the fact that those improvements will have an effect on the property values and the rent. Why is increased property value not seen as a sign of a neighborhood's success? And Brian writes, the thing not being talked about here is that tech worker is synonymous with young worker. The reality is that young people, both from the Bay Area and not, don't have anywhere to move to. So the ones who can afford it are moving to the Mission and the Lower Haight, and others like me are moving to the Outer Richmond, Northwest Oakland, and other places that provide cheaper housing. The reality is that young people, generally ages 18 to 28, both those making $30,000 and those making $130,000, need places to live. Nowhere in these conversations has there been any mention of accommodating us. And another listener writes, I grew up in New York City in the 50s and 60s. The city was in a long-term decline, largely because people worked in the city and lived in the suburbs. Here you have the opposite. People working in the suburbs, Silicon Valley, and choosing to live in the city. That's a good thing. Something to be cheered, not feared. And there's plenty of diversity in the valley. Francisco writes, fancy and very expensive stores in Valencia Street getting together to fight Jack Spade? Come on, people. Who fought you back when you were displacing old-timers in the same street? And David writes, I am having a hard time with this discussion about neocolonialism in West Oakland. Seriously, where do you find these people? West Oakland is getting better and more diverse and not the reverse. The area was sorely in need of improvement and is finally getting better. The people that are being displaced are generally willing homeowners that sell their dwellings at increased prices. They aren't being herded anywhere. Give me a break. David writes, obvious solution? Admit we have a class system and build high-rises with both large, elegantly outfitted and small, basically outfitted, but much more affordable units. And Lisa asks, and I'll ask this to anybody on the panel, are there any examples in the world where cities have navigated the tension between development and gentrification, so-called, successfully?
I was just in Berlin, and I know that Berlin has done a better job, and they're more willing to protect tenants and neighborhood identity rather than think that the free market is so sacred it must be protected at all costs.
One more email from Jason, then we'll go to your calls here. He says, people evolve, cities evolve. Why is a change from how things used to be always bad in some people's eyes? Supply and demand is in effect. Who would pay to stop gentrification? Are the opponents of gentrification willing to pay extra in taxes to fund this?
Michael, just
saying, Randy, you want to respond to that last call?
You know, what interesting question is Phil's Coffee gentrification? And people love Phil's Coffee. It's single drip coffee. It's $3 for the cheapest cup. I love Phil's, and I think it's great. But and all the hipsters hang out on 24th and Street in the Mission, and that's considered a hip place, not a gentrifying place. But it's 180 at Pete's, which gets more people in suit and ties with higher incomes. So that's the kind of cultural confusion about gentrification. I would say gentrification is an economic issue. And when you get involved in these cultural signposts, it gets very confusing.
Well, one more take on from our listeners on definitions of gentrification. I don't want to go to our callers. Joe says, gentrification is what happens as the population increases and the amount of land remains finite. And Lisa says, it's causing an epidemic of evictions, including 98-year-old women who have been in their homes for decades. John writes, it's the inevitable result when overpopulation intersects with neoliberal government philosophy. Money talks, renters walk, and I was just talking with friends who expect to be ellised out of their homes at any time. Barney writes, it's a double-edged sword. Often those residents responsible for gentrification of a neighborhood are eventually unable to afford living there. Let me get our callers on, and we begin, Connie, with you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air. Go ahead.
So my question is, would taxation of companies like Twitter, who, and correct me if I'm wrong, got a huge tax break for staying in the city. If you didn't give them a tax break and some of their money went to affordable housing, went to some fund, or even education, I mean, and you're not talking a little bit of money, but, and I know this isn't gentrification, but if we're talking about affordable housing, which is part of gentrification, can't we stop the tax breaks for companies as a way for them to say, I'm leaving if you don't give me a big tax break?
Well, this gets into the whole controversy came up in the last hour when we talked about the Twitter IPO. Anybody want to take a stab at whether Twitter should be taxed? Mayor Lee came to their rescue, well, and that is true, that they are indeed given the advantage of having a tax break.
Well, in the right? IPO, it was unanimous vote of the board. It was, I mean, Ross Mercurimi sponsored the bill that gave stock options the break, not, and it was supported by all the progressives because these companies were going to leave. Twitter wouldn't be in mid-market if they hadn't gotten the tax break. But I think the larger question is, how do we get more revenue for housing, which is a big problem because the federal and state governments have abandoned affordable housing and putting all the pressure on localities, and they don't have the resources. It's a real problem.
It seems to me that, you know, at the point where we had tax breaks, we were in a recession, and it's possible that those companies would have left, and it's possible that, you know, that it was a good – that they needed those tax breaks to stay here at that point, that they weren't kind of lying about it. But I would – it's I don't think you can make that clear case of it anymore. I mean, there's San Francisco is the place to be for tech startups, and I don't know if they need or their workers need those tax breaks anymore to be convinced to stay here. I think a lot of them would stay anyway, and a lot of new companies would start up if we didn't have those tax breaks, and if we could use some of that revenue for, you know, to mitigate some of these problems, it seems like it could be a good idea.
And we'll go to another caller, Corey. Thanks for waiting. Join us here on Forum.
Hi. Hi, thanks. Just a kind of a correction, I guess, to the statement that was made about the Outer Lands, as they're called, not being affected by so much of this gentrification and neighborhood improvement. I've been living out there for a long time, and the bulk of my friends, my partner, are all small business owners, restaurateurs, so on and so forth out there that have been living there for the last decade, and we are definitely beginning to get priced out or having businesses become in trouble or really worrying about our living situation. Like I said, the cost of my apartment has more than doubled in my building for a similar unit since 2011. So we are definitely feeling the effects of these people moving in, and the only people moving in are the affluent.
Yeah, they're not immune over there in the Outer Richmond, Randy Shaw.
They were immune.
You know, and you get successive waves of people. The tech workers might want to live on the transit corridors, but then they displace other middle class people who displace lower middle class people who displace working poor people who displace even poorer people. And you know, and it's sort of these ripples are being are spreading throughout the Bay Area. I know people in the East Bay and Marin, in the city, et cetera, everybody feels pushed and pressured by this situation.
Let me thank Corey for his call. Except the billionaires, right? Alex is on next. Alex, go ahead.
Hi. I think ultimately what we've got here is a culture war exacerbated by income disparity with the changing demographic, much like the Jewish migration to Palestine or the current Tea Party's backlash to the voting demographic change. But, you know, that's on the gentrification edge here. But ultimately, the boat is full. Even before Twitter came, we were having crazy rising rents, and we have Ed Lee saying, well, we want to keep jobs in the city, but you didn't keep jobs in the city. You brought more jobs to the city and filled up a city that was already at capacity, gave them tax breaks. So, you know, yeah, I know they put a little bit of money into low-income housing, all that at Twitter, but ultimately, when I passed there yesterday, I'm a cab driver. In the cab, you saw the news cameras out front because of their IPO, and you saw protesters with a coffin that said affordable housing on the coffin out front. And that's the truth. The boat is full. I mean, declaring Lyft Day, again, I'm a cab driver, Renegade Pirate Uninsured Cab Day was bringing people in from Pacifica to the city. The boat is full. What if mid-market was turned into low-income housing instead of tax breaks for large corporations to bring outsiders in and homogenize the community while, you know, making it impossible for anybody below the 1% to live here?
Yeah, thank you for that, Alex. I think what Alex has touched on, I mean, just in terms of housing, is really the vortex of this whole argument and controversy about gentrification, availability of housing and displacement, and but also the changing demographic. Randy, you were talking about change in culture, and he mentioned that again. And I'm often struck by that fact that there are millionaires who are buying properties who have no roots here. So you do have a changing culture.
Right.
And people people calling in and saying, boy, I lived in San Francisco 5 generations. I lived in Oakland 4 generations, whatever. Can't afford to buy a house, period. Can't live there.
No, I think the question really, I mean, we can talk all we want about gentrification and then your whole theme here of the pricing out, but the question is, how do you have solutions? And that's why you have to do things like change the Ellis Act at the state level so people are not afraid. I mean, we pass rent control. There's things you can do. You do need to build more affordable housing and figure out financing. The mayor did get a $1.3 billion affordable housing trust fund through the voters, but we need more, obviously, and more methods to be. Mid-market should have more affordable housing. There's not a lot of sites for it. It hasn't historically been there, but we have to figure out ways. So I think we need to really – I mean, it's great to beat up on tech, but they're here. They're a major economic force. Let's have them be part of the solution and solve these problems. They're not leaving. And so let's look at how we can do that, because everyone's agreed that no one is happy about this level of displacement and fear. I mean, I've worked with tenants my whole career, and the notion we protected them through zoning, through eviction protections, through all, demolition controls, everything. And then we get this state law being misapplied where everyone in a small building feels at risk.
Hi, Daylight. Let me get a response to you from this listener named Ben, who says, could your guests from West Oakland speak to the idea of black gentrification of downtown Oakland? I've heard and met many young black business owners in downtown Oakland who are excited about a particular flavor of gentrification. Is that a myth or small growing reality?
I think it's a myth. I don't even know what the comment is based on. Things like Uptown and First Fridays, there's a tension that First Fridays is centered in a certain part of Oakland. And it doesn't include the entire artscape, which reaches down into Old Oakland and into West Oakland. And these people are not included in First Fridays. We're priced out of Uptown. So there are a lot of new startup programs that encourage first-time buyers. But those things are kind of on the surface. You know, a rising black middle class does not mean that the economic disparity between affluent whites and poor blacks is not real. So the thing of access, there are things that are silent that aren't being talked about. Back to development with the consciousness, I don't really have a beef with techies who do like to be on the transportation corridors, which is what makes West Oakland so popular. It's 5 minutes from San Francisco. The BART trains run every 15 minutes. However, when you have individual developers who come in, I'm much more interested in rogue real estate developers who are getting filthy rich. When you have real estate developers come in who can deal in cash and who make a profit on the foreclosure market, where I can't go buy a house, even if I'm willing to pay $200,000 for a house that's priced at $150,000 on a 30-year mortgage, I can't buy it. If a developer walks in and has $175,000 in cash, we have houses being scooped up for cash. There's no way to compete. There's no way to get in. There's no access. Even the redevelopment of businesses. There is a particular spot in West Oakland, Tintinwood, that now hosts a new restaurant, and good for them. But they're there because they have access to financing and ready cash and can afford to develop those spaces. I don't see a large number of black startups in downtown Oakland. I'm not aware of that.
Let me cut to the chase on that and actually ask you, Rebecca, is this more big money in real estate and the developers or the techies? I mean, you read your work and it seems like, you know, the techies are changing all this. Silicon Valley's changing all this. But she has a point about the developers' role in it.
Absolutely. And I remember during the dot-com boom, the dot-coms all disappeared, but developers and real estate speculators made a ton of money. But I think we're talking about two different things. One is about housing and economics and maybe class. And the other thing is about culture. And Silicon Valley, you know, in some ways is supposed to be progressive because it's not homophobic. It's often kind of misogynist, but that's another story, you know, and it has some liberal values, but it's also very libertarian. You have stuff like the guy, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, giving a bunch of money to advertise how great the Keystone Pipeline would be. You have a lot of, you have the libertarian billionaires who just want to withdraw from the U.S. so they don't have to pay any taxes because, you know, and it's there's a lot of questions about the values that, you know, go from these big questions about the richest people on earth that are the new lords of the Bay Area and about the manners of people on the street. And, you know, so we're, I think there's a lot of overlap, but there's separate things. There's culture and there's economics.
Although we do see changes in the culture. In fact, I'm looking at a listener named Judd writing, as a visual artist living in San Francisco, my biggest issue with the tech-fueled gentrification is there's little or no support for what I do among the techies. I would be perfectly happy with all the change if they simply supported what makes the city great, but instead they seem to find no value in the arts in general. Seems like a sweeping generalization, but it is a lot of the indictment that one keeps hearing about the so-called techies and the culture. They don't care enough about the nonprofits. They don't care enough about culture, about the arts. That's a subject for another day, because we're getting to the end of this hour, alas. I'm sorry and apologize to all of you whose emails and Facebook and tweets and so forth I couldn't get to here. Obviously, this hits a nerve, and I want to extend thanks to those who participated on this panel this morning, Aidele Nzenga and Randy Shaw and Rebecca Solnit and Farhad Manju. Also, want to mention again that Rebecca will be appearing tonight at the third floor of McRosky Mattress Factory at 7:30 and tomorrow at Most Books in Berkeley at 7:30, actually at 7 o'clock tonight. And also mention that this is Veterans Day, and I want to simply give, for lack of a better way to describe it, a shout out to all those veterans who are listening to us, who have served this country, and who really deserve recognition. And let us continue to at least respect whatever they did, regardless of how we feel about the wars they were in. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank all of those responsible behind the scenes here today and remind you that you can continue this discussion actually on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Lauerberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClymans. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.